In our last class on Daniel, we had an introduction to the book, and in this class, we actually get into chapter 1. It is not a very long chapter compared to some of the others, and it's hard to believe that, well, I don't know if it's hard to believe or not, but I was going to say it's hard to believe that we'd spend the whole session on just chapter 1, but it's also hard to believe that we would get through two chapters, because chapter 2 is very long, and there's much to say about it. See, in chapter 1, there are no prophecies given. Just some historical information, points of interest, but in my opinion, not enough to occupy a whole session. And when we get into chapter 2, there's enough to occupy several sessions. So what I suspect will happen in this class is that we will get through chapter 1 and broach chapter 2, but not get all the way through chapter 2. We may get so far as everything except interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And we'll have to save that for another class later. That's what I'm predicting, but I may be wrong. We'll see how far we get. And by the way, my voice is not quite natural today. I'm still have a cough. I may be coughing and sneezing a little bit during the class. I prepare you for that. I'm far enough away from those of you in the classroom that you probably won't catch anything from me, and those on video are fairly safe. Okay. Daniel chapter 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles to the treasure house of his God. Now, we have already talked about the fact that this speaks of the coming of Nebuchadnezzar to Jerusalem as being in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, whereas Jeremiah 25:1 speaks of the same event as happening in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. The problem is easily resolved when you realize that the Babylonians used one method of reckoning the years of a king, and the Jews used another. Jeremiah followed the Jewish reckoning, being a Jew living in Jerusalem, writing to Jewish readers. Daniel, living in Babylon, writing to readers who were in Babylon, used the Babylonian reckoning. By the Babylonian reckoning, the year that the Jews would have called the first year of Jehoiakim, the Babylonians would call the accession year. And therefore, the year that the Jews would call the second year, the Babylonians would call the third year of the same guy. Excuse me, the first year of the same guy. My mistake. Then the year that the Jews would call the third year, the Babylonians would call only the second year. And all the way through, the Babylonians would be one number behind, because the first, what the Jews called the first year, the Babylonians called the accession year, and then they began numbering after that. So where the Jews would speak of the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the Babylonians would speak of that as the third year of Jehoiakim, and that solves what is on the surface a bit of a problem, but it's a quite simple solution. It also solves another problem that comes up later in Daniel when we remember this kind of reckoning. This siege of Jerusalem did not result in the destruction of Jerusalem. This siege of which we read in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim is in the year 605 B.C. It is the first time that the Babylonians came against Jerusalem, and they did very little in the way of destruction, and they didn't take away all the captives. In fact, we will read that they took, they took some of the articles of the house of God. That is, some of the things in the temple. The temple's plates and bowls and snuffers and things like that were largely made of gold, and therefore of value just because of their weight in gold. The temple at this point was not destroyed. We do not read of any destruction at all of property, just a confiscation. And in addition to that, we shall read that some persons were taken into captivity, including Daniel and his three friends. But what I'd like to point out at this time is that it was on this occasion that many things, articles from the temple, were taken away into Babylon, and it is said that they were brought into the treasure house of the Babylonians' god. This would no doubt be Bel, the god, principal god of the Babylonians, or else Nebo. Nebo and Bel were the chief gods of the Babylonians. Later on in chapter 5, we'll find that a later Babylonian king, Belshazzar, calls for these articles to be brought to him at a feast. These articles that Nebuchadnezzar had put in storage were then brought out by one of his successors, Belshazzar, and they were later used to drink toasts to the idolatrous gods of the Babylonians. And this was an outrage to the God of heaven. These articles had been holy unto the Lord, had been dedicated to the worship of Jehovah. And when they were pressed into the service of false gods, that was the last straw, as it were, and God brought down the Babylonian kingdom and gave it over to the Medes and the Persians that night. However, this taking of these articles and putting them in the treasure house of the God of Babylon in verse 2 of chapter 1 anticipates the later development of chapter 5, that they will be taken out and used for corrupt purposes. Now, in verse 3, it says, "Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there is no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans." Now, I don't know whether Nebuchadnezzar followed this policy with every country that he conquered. He may well have done so. It would appear that he may have. But we know that when he came to Jerusalem, he noticed or assumed that there were people of high qualifications to serve in a royal court, his own. And he expected to find them among those of royal and noble blood, those who were already serving in a court or who were already in the court of a kingdom. And so the royal seed and other nobles were taken. Now, it's not so much that these people had experience serving in the court, because the royalty doesn't serve. Royalty usually is served. But by taking nobles and royal family away to become servants in his own court, he is therefore, of course, expressing his own superiority, his own sovereignty over those who had once ruled. They now come to serve in his court in Babylon, showing that he is, in fact, as he is later called in chapter 2, a king of kings. He is the ruler over rulers. These who were taken were qualified by natural good looks as well as intellectual powers and the ability to learn quickly. I'm not sure how this particular characteristic was appraised, in the short time they had to select these men. I mean, they came into Jerusalem and they were to gather these men and take them away. I'm not sure how the ability to learn language and so forth was assessed with all these men who were to the Babylonians, total strangers. Perhaps they looked at their own. There must have been some, perhaps there were records of their own educational attainments. Daniel and his friends who were among those taken might well have been still in school, and therefore they may have been the top of their class. But we don't know whether Daniel is of the royal seed or not, of the king's descendants, as it says in verse 3, or simply of noble blood. But he was not of a low-ranking family, he and his friends, and they were among those that were taken. Now, it was appointed to Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring these young men, and we later learn that they were committed to the care of he who was the master of the eunuchs, which has led many to suggest, and it's, in fact, I think it's probably likely that Daniel became a eunuch. Now, a eunuch was a male who was castrated, and therefore, of course, would not be tempted by the king's harem. And many times kings, when they conquered people, or even if they didn't conquer people, if they had servants serving in their household around the harem or around the other women, they would, or even if they weren't serving around women, they would often castrate them and make eunuchs of them, because it was considered that a man who is a eunuch will not be A, tempted by the women, and B, distracted by such things as a desire to marry and other things that cause a man to take his mind off his work. And it apparently was generally considered in ancient times that the best servants of the king are those who have no other attractions, no other things to distract them from their loyalty to the king's work. And we all know, I think, if maybe you're too young to know this, but when a man, when his hormones get going, he's practically good for nothing for a while anyway. We've seen too many people wash out of this school for no better reason but that they were not eunuchs. And a lot of times the performance in class goes way down as soon as someone notices someone of the opposite sex that appeals to them and decides that it's, you know, in the spring of the year, you know, that they need to apply themselves to something other than their studies. And this is, I think, recognized in ancient cultures that if someone's going to loyally and undistractedly and permanently serve the king, it's best if he's not going to be married or be attracted to marriage as an option. And so many times, not only in Babylon, but in many of the ancient lands, those who were serving the king in the highest offices were made eunuchs. And it is almost certain that Daniel and his friends were made eunuchs, therefore, too. It's interesting that many of the other prophets, in fact, probably most of the other considerable prophets in the Bible, there is something said about them in the Bible about their marital state. In Isaiah's case, we know that he was married because he had two sons. In the case of Jeremiah, he was specifically told not to marry because those who had wives and children were going to have great occasion to grieve at the Holocaust that came upon the Jews in 586 B.C., which Jeremiah would live to see. Ezekiel had a wife, and she died during the time of his ministry. You remember he was not permitted to mourn for her because his lack of mourning for his wife was to depict God's judgment that Jerusalem, which was to fall, God's wife, was not worthy of being mourned upon her fall. And Hosea also married, and we know some things about that. So there's many times the marital status of a prophet is significant and mentioned in Scripture. Daniel, however, there's nothing said of him marrying or not marrying. It's just not an issue in his prophecy. There's no reference to him having a wife, having children, or specifically being told not to marry, as Jeremiah was. It's just not an issue. And it may well be because he was a eunuch and marriage was not even a consideration for eunuchs. And he was committed to the care of the man who was the overseer of the eunuchs, the master of the eunuchs. And the fact that he served under this master of the eunuchs suggests that he was one of the eunuchs. Anyway, it says in verse 5, "And the king appointed for them," that is for these young men who were taken from the nobility of Judah and taken back to Babylon, "the king of Babylon appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, that at the end of that time they might serve before the king." Now that training for 3 years apparently was linguistics and literature training, because we are told that they were selected in verse 4 because of their ability to learn the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. They were to be thoroughly saturated with the culture. That's what literature does. When you imbibe the literature of a society, you pick up its culture. You might not adopt its culture, but you certainly become acquainted with its culture. Culture is largely passed along through literature and language. And so the idea was to reorient these young men. They were Jews by religion, by nationality, by loyalty, and by culture. And by the way, the Jews had a very different culture than did Gentile nations. But the purpose of this was no doubt to make Babylonians out of them, to cause them to surrender their culture and religion and to adopt the culture and religious ideas of the Babylonians. If this was the desire of Nebuchadnezzar, it singularly failed in the case of these four men, Daniel and his three friends, because they did not give up their religion. They did learn the language. In fact, Daniel's three friends even began to go by their Babylonian names instead of their Jewish names, as we'll see shortly. Though Daniel does not ever take his Babylonian name. He is given a Babylonian name, but he doesn't seem to wear it. He doesn't use it. And it may be a stubborn loyalty to his Jewish heritage that causes him to do that, or it may be some other reason. We're not told, but we shall find that his three friends are given Babylonian names by which they are forever after known. Daniel is given a Babylonian name, but then we don't hear him using it very much. He still goes by Daniel, his Hebrew name, which means God is my judge, by the way. Daniel means God is my judge. Now, it says that they were to be given 3 years of training, and after that they would be fit to serve before the king of Babylon. So what we read in the remainder of this chapter is what happened during the period of training. In chapter 2, we shall read of what happened when their training was completed, apparently. Verse 6, "Now among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names." He renamed them. To give different names to someone, in one sense, is showing your authority over them. To be able to name something or someone shows that you essentially own it. And parents name their children, and their ability to do so, their right to do so, speaks of their authority over their child. Adam gave names to all the animals, which is not significant except that it showed that he had authority over them. I mean, whatever names he gave them, who knows? We don't even know what language he spoke now. So they don't bear the same names now that he gave them. But the point of mentioning that he named the animals is that it shows that he had authority over them. God often changed people's names in order to speak of his call and claims upon their life. He renamed Abram Abraham. He renamed Jacob Israel. He renamed lots of people. Jesus renamed some of his disciples. Simon he called Peter. And so forth. The king of Babylon gave his master of the eunuchs the authority to exercise this authority over the captives also, to rename them. But the renaming of them in this case probably wasn't so much an act of showing power and authority over them as it was another step in trying to reshape their identities from that of being Jews to that of being Babylonians. They all had Jewish names, but they were all given Babylonian names. They were learning the Babylonian language. They were learning the Babylonian culture. And so they were assigned names that would presumably cause them to more quickly forget their Jewish heritage, their parents, the names their parents had given them, the names their fellow Jews had known them by in their old life. They now have a new life in Babylon. They have a new name, a Babylonian name. They are fully absorbed, it is hoped, by the Babylonians into the new life as Babylonian citizens instead of Jews. This, as I say, didn't take very well, though, with these men. Now, as we see, it says in verse 7, to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, which is, by the way, not to be mistaken for Belshazzar, though in English the names look very similar. To Hananiah, he gave the name Shadrach. To Mishael, the name Meshach. To Azariah, the name Abednego. I don't know enough about the linguistics of it, but it looks as if there's a possibility, at least, that Mishael and Meshach are very similar names. And I don't know about the others. There may be some attempt made to give them Babylonian names that in some way were etymologically similar to their original names. But that is only evident in that one name, Mishael being Meshach. The other names don't, in English, look very much the same. And I don't know whether they, in their original languages, are close or not. Verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, why did Daniel not want to eat the food of the Babylonians? Well, there are several suggestions that might be made. There are people today who are, for religious conviction, vegetarians. And we know that Daniel later requested that he be permitted to eat a diet entirely of vegetables. And we find that it suited him well. It made him healthy. I mean, he and his friends they thrived on such a diet. And so people who are vegetarians today would suggest that Daniel and his friends, being holy men, would not eat meat. They are vegetarian. Well, they did certainly become vegetarian in this case, but we have no reason to believe they were vegetarians before they were taken into Babylon. Jews, generally speaking, were not vegetarian, and even the holiest of Jews had to eat meat sometimes if he was going to keep the law, because they had to eat their sacrifices, and they had to eat the Passover, and so forth. There's a lot of meat in their diet prescribed by law. It's almost certain that the Jewish young men were not vegetarians before they went into Babylon. And therefore, their refusal to eat the king's food was not because of vegetarian convictions. It also is not the case, in my opinion, that they were trying to be ascetic. You know what asceticism is? Asceticism is where you deprive yourself of certain legitimate pleasures and so forth just to be more spiritual. In some religions, this would be seen by, you know, laying on a bed of nails or just, you know, St. Francis and his people walking around barefoot in sackcloth and so forth in the snow. Just being ascetic, meaning that although there'd be nothing wrong with being more comfortable than you are. You are deliberately depriving yourself of comforts and luxuries in order to show your dedication and your holiness to, and your commitment to spiritual things. Asceticism, by the way, is not a New Testament concept. It's not advocated in the New Testament. In fact, Paul seems to speak very negatively of it in the closing verses of Colossians chapter 2. He talks about those who, though as Christians should be risen with Christ, they as though still living, or they were dead with Christ, they should not be living under ordinances such as taste not, touch not, handle not, which he said are not of any use for bringing the flesh into subjection. And Jesus himself was not an ascetic. John the Baptist was. And Jesus made a distinction between them. I think it was in the 11th chapter of Matthew, when John had sent the messengers to Jesus to ask if he was the one who was to come or not. And Jesus sent the messengers back with his answer. Jesus then spoke to the crowds about John the Baptist. And he says in verse 18 of Matthew 11, "For John came neither eating nor drinking." By the way, in Luke's parallel it says in Luke 7:33, "neither eating bread nor drinking wine." And they say he has a demon. "The Son of Man came eating and drinking," presumably meaning eating bread and drinking wine, the very things that John the Baptist didn't eat and drink. "And they say, look, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." So Jesus made a distinction between his own lifestyle and that of John. John, who ate only locusts and wild honey and lived in a garment of camel's hair, which is like sackcloth, and lived in the wilderness, he was a true ascetic, monkish type of guy. Jesus was the opposite. John the Baptist didn't drink wine. He didn't eat bread. He didn't have a normal diet. He didn't have normal comforts of ordinary life and so forth. But Jesus did. Jesus ate and drank those things, and he went to feasts and was even accused of being a glutton and a winebibber. So Jesus obviously did not adopt an ascetic lifestyle. Now some feel that maybe Daniel and his friends were trying to be spiritual by asceticism. Why? Because it says what he rejected in verse 8 were the king's delicacies. Later on, however, it would appear that Daniel didn't mind ordinarily eating delicacies. In chapter 10 of Daniel, verses 2 and 3, in Daniel 10, 2 and 3, it says, "In those days I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 full weeks, and I ate no pleasant food. No meat or wine came to my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled." Now notice, he didn't eat delicacies, he didn't drink wine or eat meat for how long? 3 weeks. Suggesting that when those 3 weeks were over, he did eat those things again. And before, I mean, this is a special set time he put aside for not eating such things. Now, of course, chapter 10 is considerably later, like 70 or more years later than chapter 1. Daniel had become established in that part of the world as a leader, and he was able to choose his own diet. In chapter 1, he was basically a captive, and he ate what they gave him to eat. But at the time he was a ruling official in Persia in chapter 10, he could pretty much choose his own diet. Now notice, when he did choose his own diet, he did not abstain ordinarily from wine, or from meat, or from pleasant foods. He was not ascetic, nor was he a vegetarian. He did abstain from them for 3 weeks, but that was a special situation of mourning and fasting. It was a partial fast. But what I'm saying is, chapter 10, verses 2 and 3 make it clear that when Daniel, later in life, abstained from meat, it was special, for special reasons. When he abstained from wine, it was for special reasons. When he abstained from pleasant foods, it was for special reasons, for a time of fasting. Therefore, we don't find that Daniel was a man who, in principle, objected to delicacies or, in principle, objected to meat. So why did he refuse the king's delicacies and require vegetables as his diet in chapter 1? Well, it seems to me the only reason that makes sense is that because the Babylonians did not eat their meat in a manner that was, to the Jewish diet, clean. First of all, the Jewish butchers were required to drain all the blood out of every animal that they prepared to eat. The Jew was not allowed to eat any blood. Virtually all other cultures ate bloody meat. just like we do. Red meat, with a lot of red blood in it. And the Babylonians would certainly not be conscientious about this Jewish scruple. If they served meat, it would have blood in it. Furthermore, they wouldn't have the same dietary restrictions as to what kinds of meat they would eat. In all likelihood, the Babylonians enjoyed pork once in a while, and certain kinds of shellfish that the Jews were not allowed to eat. And it was simpler for these Jews to request, could we just eat vegetables? Not because they objected to meat in principle, but they could never be sure that the meat they were served had been prepared in a way that their Jewish conscience would allow them to take. They could not observe the preparation of the meat, and therefore, just to avoid any chance of eating unclean foods or unkosher meats, they could just eat vegetables because there were no unclean vegetables in the Jewish law. And therefore, I think it was their concern to not defile themselves with unkosher food, the kind of food that any devout Jew would abstain from. But they had no control in chapter 1, where Daniel later, when he did eat meat, he had control over what he ate. He was a ruling man. He could prepare his meat the way he wanted. He could probably have his own butcher to do whatever he wanted. So it's not that Daniel objected to meat or dainty foods. It's that, in particular, the Babylonian diet and food preparation could not be trusted to bring foods that the Jew, living under kosher laws of diet, could eat with good conscience. So I think that is what motivated Daniel. Now, what I see very important about verse 8, and there's a line in there that it just stands out as the chief line in chapter 1 of value to the Christian today. It says, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. Now, Daniel in Babylon was not much different, in much of a different situation than you or I as Christians in a world that is anti-God, anti-Christ. Christianity calls us to a standard of living which, if we lived it, will go against the grain of the culture of the world we live in. And that doesn't matter whether the culture of the world we live in is American or European or African or Asian. It wouldn't matter. South American, every worldly culture is a worldly culture. And therefore, certain things are accepted. Certain things are countenanced that Christianity cannot countenance. Certain practices that the world has no conscience about, but Christians should have conscience about. Things that the world does quite routinely, but if a Christian did, would be defiling and would be compromising. And that's what Daniel's situation was. He had been a Jew in a Jewish culture. Now he was a Jew in a Babylonian culture. And to a certain extent, he probably picked up what things in the culture of Babylon that he could in good conscience. For instance, I'm sure he went ahead and learned the language. I'm sure he went ahead and read the literature. He may have even gone by the name Belteshazzar, when standing before the king. We don't know. When he wrote about himself, he didn't use that name, but he may have used it in the court. What we can say is that Daniel probably allowed himself to be assimilated into the culture, or we might say in modern missiology terms, to be culturally sensitive to his environment. But there were places that he drew the line. In modern missions, one of the most frequently spoken words these days is cultural sensitivity, or being culturally sensitive. And when you go to a foreign country, Christian missionaries are encouraged to adopt as much as possible the cultural norms of the people among whom they serve, and, of course, to be sensitive to such things as people in that culture might find offensive that we don't find offensive. And I agree with this, but I think it can be taken too far. I think, for example, there is that attitude in many churches in America today. We want to be culturally sensitive. In this country, since we're not talking about missions, we use the term culturally relevant. And so if the hymns, they're not culturally relevant. The average person off the street comes in and it's not his kind of music. Services where the Bible is read a lot and it's archaic and it's from another time and so forth, and that's not culturally relevant. People want to have anecdotes from modern times. They want to hear testimonies from sports figures. They want to They want to hear movie stars give their testimonies. They want entertainment. We live in an entertainment culture, and the churches, in order to be culturally relevant, in many cases are adopting and bringing into the sanctuary the entertainment culture. And what is, you know, things are chosen to be put forward as representative of Christianity into the onlooking world, such things as make us look contemporary and culturally with it, you know, on the cutting edge. Now, I think that some things in our culture are neutral. I think there are some things in the culture that are not to be shunned. There are some clothing styles, for example, that I think Christians can wear, alike with non-Christians, and I don't think that Christians have to adopt some kind of really old-fashioned, frumpy clothing style just to look different than the world, because, frankly, not everything that the world wears as clothing is objectionable. But Christians do need to have their own standards where they will draw the line. Like Daniel, I think he adopted some of the culture of the Babylonians, but he knew where to draw the line. And there are some styles of clothing which the world adopts and thinks nothing of today, which probably a lot of Christians have not drawn the line in the proper place, and they just follow. And this would be usually in where the standards of modesty have been violated. But, I know I was raised in a church growing up that I thought nothing of the teenage girls at a beach party wearing bikinis, you know. I mean, it was no problem. It was Southern California culture. And it was the worldly culture, but it was also the culture of our youth group and our church. And I, today, of course, feel strange about having been of that mindset, because such clothing, I think, I'm not trying to be old-fashioned. I'm just trying to say we need to be more concerned about holiness. We need to be concerned more about avoiding stumbling people and just more modest in general. That is, of Christian virtue that is advocated in the New Testament. There are ways in which Christians, by adopting cultural practices of the world around them, defile themselves in their testimony. And where we make some little compromises that we don't consider to be great, these often start a snowball effect where we end up breaking standards that we do think are big, and we wonder why we can't get a handle on them, particularly in the area of sexual purity. I mean, so many Christians in this culture have problems with sexual fantasies or even sexual behavior that is inappropriate, and they know it's inappropriate, and the amazing thing is they wish they could get over it. They wish they could stop it, but it masters them. They don't know why they can't get over it. And a lot of times they don't realize that the reason that they have been mastered by sin is because at an earlier stage, in that snowball effect, they've accepted things without question, which are cultural norms, which they should have stood against earlier on. The kinds of magazines they'll let themselves look at. I'm not talking about pornography. I'm just talking about entertainment magazines. The kind of clothing that Christians sometimes wear, even to church, or when they're not at church, in casual settings. I mean, some kinds of clothing are just plain immodest. The world thinks nothing of it. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians think nothing of it, or it'd be better if they could think nothing of it. But the ones who wear it think nothing of it. The preacher doesn't think of rebuking it, but many times people who view those Christians can't get it out of their mind. They think a great deal of it. And to make compromises in the area of dress or pictures or movies or television, even television commercials, which present things that are sexually arousing, we find ourselves, at least I once found myself, and I imagine many people do, thinking, well, hey, I live in the world. I've got to be in the world, not of it. But, I mean, I can't, you know, I can't just never go to the beach. I can't just never go to the pool. I can't just never walk into 7-Eleven. I mean, I've got to live in this world. And that is true. Well, I mean, it may not be true that I have to go to the beach. The fact of the matter is, if your eye causes you to offend, pluck it out and cast it from you. If your hand causes you to offend, pluck it out, cast it from you. If going to the beach causes you to offend, that should be something you'd be willing to pluck out. It'd be better to go to heaven without the beach than to go to hell with it. There are things that we've never even thought of cutting out of our lives, because, I mean, that would seem so extreme in our culture. But you look at our culture, tell me, and who's extreme? You, who's being holy, or our culture today? Who's really being extreme? Our culture is what's extreme, extremely corrupt. And if we had the sensitivities Daniel did, now listen, eating clean foods and unclean foods is not the biggest issue in the law. It's probably not the biggest issue to any holy man. It is an issue to a holy man, a Jew. But there are bigger issues than that, like bowing down to idols, an issue that came up later in chapter 3. And you know what? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't bow down to the idol. But perhaps, and others did, including, I would assume other Jews must have, because there were other Jews in captivity with them, and yet those three alone remained standing when everybody else bowed down to the idol in chapter 3. It is possible that the reason that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were able to stand against the great vice of bowing down to an idol is because they and Daniel made no compromises in the lesser areas. They had purposed in their hearts. Daniel had purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. And I think that Christians have a vague desire to be holy in many cases. But one reason they aren't any more holy than they are is they have never purposed in their heart to be undefiled. And this is where holiness starts. It starts not by cutting off a few bad habits. It starts with making a deliberate, firm, unyielding purpose in your spirit, saying, I am going to live as a holy person in an unholy world. And I'm going to keep my eyes and ears open for things which in the world may be defiling, and I'm going to avoid them. And I might even get into trouble. Daniel came close to getting into trouble for this. Actually, God vindicated him in it, but he could have gotten into trouble with this if God hadn't come through for him. He could have gotten in trouble with the king. But he had a purpose in his heart. He didn't care what the king thought. He didn't care what the master of eunuchs thought. He didn't care if the others who were compromising, who were captives from Judah and who were compromising, he didn't care what they thought, if they thought he was being holier than thou. He had a purpose, and that was to not defile himself, but to remain pure and undefiled for God. Now, it's interesting because in verses 8 and the verses that follow, the first few, we only read of Daniel having this resolve. But as it turns out, it affects Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as well, because we read of that in verse 11, that these three friends of Daniel become affected too. Now, it's interesting, in verse 8 it doesn't say, but Daniel and his friends purposed in their hearts. It looks as though Daniel was the one who is the leader, the spiritual leader of the group. He had this purpose. Maybe the others did too. But his purpose was outstanding, worth mentioning separately. And his purpose apparently helped his friends to make the right choice too. Like leaven in a lump of dough, a Christian who remains pure and uncompromised will begin to infect other believers with his convictions. Not all. We don't read that any of the other Jews took the stand that Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego did, but Daniel didn't end up standing alone. His uncompromised stand won him some company in the persons of his three friends. And it's been my experience. You know, let me think. I've gotten some letters somewhere. Who am I hearing from? I think it's people who write to our magazine have been saying, you know, well, I feel so lonely in these convictions we have. You know, we're homeschooling our kids, and we're not watching television, and we're, you know, we got these rare convictions, and we don't have any friends who have these convictions. We can't find anyone who thinks that way. We feel so alone. I've never really quite felt that way, because I've never really been alone. There have been many times where I took a stand, like in Orange County when I was younger, and I took a stand in some areas of holiness that I didn't know anyone else who was taking that stand, but no sooner did I take that stand, but several others who were hungry for the same thing became aware of it and became close friends. And it was not long before there was a growing company of people who had these convictions. Same thing happened in Santa Cruz, and basically, I've never been without company. I mean, completely without company in my convictions. Sometimes I've been the first in my block to have certain convictions, but It wasn't long before there were others. And I think that it just takes resolve, because you see, the world doesn't have any resolve for the most part. I mean, most people in the world don't know what they're living for. They're just flowing. They're just flowing with the culture without thinking, and most Christians do the same. But when one person says, no, that is not right. I'm not going to go along with that. Most people think, what? What are you, some kind of weirdo, extremist fanatic? But there's always others who say, you know, you're right. My heart says that too. I just never thought to say that. I never had the courage to stand up and say that. But when one person does, it gives courage to others. Paul said in Philippians chapter 1, I think it was, that his being in prison caused other people who had not otherwise been as bold to become more bold in preaching the gospel. Well, if you know, he's taking a stand and paying for it with imprisonment. Yeah, I always felt I should do that too. I just never knew anyone who did it. But since he did it, I'll do it. You know, I mean, there are Christians who are weak, but they know what's right. And if you take a stand in your church or in your circle or whatever for holiness, a lot of people are going to misunderstand, but there's going to be some there who say, you know, I always kind of thought that way too. I just never could bring myself to say so. And your stand, your convictions become positively infectious upon those that God is calling to live holy. And you probably won't be without company in your convictions for very long if you take an uncompromised stand. You might not have a lot of company. And Daniel didn't either. But notice, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed you food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So he was concerned that if these men didn't eat a normal diet, what he considered a normal diet, their health would suffer. And then the king would say, hey, Ashpenaz, why are these three men not healthy? Are these four men not healthy? And say, well, I haven't been giving them what you've been ordering to give them. And that would possibly cost him his life. And I think he was quite in touch with the king's attitudes. I think he's probably right. He probably would have lost his life had that been the case. So Daniel said to the steward, I mean, we see how quick the king is to order the death of all the wise men in chapter 2, just because they can't tell him what his dream was. There's every reason to believe that men who offended him otherwise would pay for it with their life also. So verse 11, so Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be examined before you and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So the idea was, well, listen, we're here for 3 years before the king has to see us. Just give us 10 days. If we're not looking healthy after 10 days, it's easy to fatten us up within the time that we have before we have to stand before the king, and you won't be endangered. So the man consented to this in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. So in other words, they were able for the rest of their period of training to eat the diet that they wanted to. God gave them favor. You know, yeah, yes, Rob? The wine? I don't know. We can see later in chapter 10 that drinking wine was not a foreign thing to Daniel, ordinarily. But I think it's very possible that they mixed wine with other substances too. I don't know what. But mixing wine is spoken of in the Bible. I don't know very much about those practices.